You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.
This is Jen Ramage. Today on the program, I'm joined by novelist Kate Atkinson, winner of the Whitbread First Novel of the Year Award for her work behind the scenes at the museum. This book was later chosen as the Whitbread Book of the Year. She's also the author of a short story collection titled Not the End of the World, and three other critically acclaimed novels, Human Croquet, Emotionally Weird, and Case Histories. She joins us here today to talk about One Good Turn, a novel and a thriller of sorts that again features our irresistibly reluctant detective, Jackson Brody, who's still addicted to those plaintive tunes of female country and western singers and loving those fast cars, but this time retired from his profession. He goes to Edinburgh with another character from Case Histories, this dramatic, larger-than-life actress Julia, who was a client of his in Case Histories, and now, in One Good Turn, is his girlfriend. Welcome to the program, Kate Atkinson.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So 2 years after the events of Case Histories, we find Jackson Brody retired from his profession. He's a millionaire. He inherited a lot of money from one of his clients who died in the last book. Rather lucky, but of course he's burdened by this money.
As I always knew he would be.
He's not a man who likes happiness, I think can say.
No, I did think. I can no longer put myself back to the point at the end of Case Histories where I thought that it should all end up with, like, you know, him being incredibly rich and everybody sort of walking off into the sunset. But I do remember thinking at the time, boy, he's going to have to pay for this in some way.
And pay he does in this.
Yes, he does. Pay with guilt, really.
Yeah, with guilt and not knowing his place in the world. I mean, we find him here. He's retired. He stumbles and witnesses this car rage that happens at the beginning of the book. He's at this fringe festival in Edinburgh with his girlfriend who, for the first time since he's known her, is actually acting in something, though she claims to be an actress and a good one at that. And he's waiting outside and witnesses this traffic accident. It looks like a case of road rage, and from this moment, this collision, everything else follows. Mm-hmm. The witnesses involved are involved in ways we don't know, and you take us on this kind of topsy-turvy ride. And he's the one who is accused of assault, spends a night in jail, finds himself on the run and trying to prove something rather than taking it easy as he does and follow the clues. Tell us about this moment, this beginning where this accident happens, and who are the major characters here? We'll flesh them out a bit in a moment.
Yeah, I always knew I wanted to start with all the characters in one place, not knowing each other, and then moving off back into their own stories and then meeting up again at the end. And really hardly, their paths hardly cross, really. They touch on each other and they're very involved with each other, but they don't know it. So there is Jackson, who is very much the reluctant bystander and really doesn't want to be involved at all. And Martin, who is writes very soft-boiled crime novels, who tries to save the victim of the road rage, and does save the victim of the road rage, in fact. And he's very he's a very put upon character, I think. He's kind of dweeby. He's a nerd, but he has a good heart, I think.
Well, for an example, you know, his main character, Nina Riley, is this woman who inherits a detective agency from her uncle, and she's very chaste. You know, nothing happens to her.
Absolutely. Yes.
But she solves this amazing crime.
And Martin is very chaste. I think chaste is a good word for Martin. He's just, you know, the rougher world. I think he would like to be part of that, more of the rough and tumble of the world, but somehow he's incapable of actually joining in. And I kind of, you know, I feel for him a lot. And of course, he's a writer. So everything that's said to him has been said to me as a writer. So all of it, you know, you're so short and all these things. So it was a good place to put those things, I found. And so he becomes involved much more so than Jackson. And then the other witness to the road rage is Gloria, who's 59-year-old housewife married to a very crooked property developer who spends, I don't think it's giving away the plot by saying her husband spends the entire novel in a coma. And indeed, the more he was in a coma, the more I began to dislike him in this book, even though he never appears as a character. And she is probably the character who's closest to me that I've ever written, I think. I feel kind of this huge sense of identification with her because she's so cross at people not doing what they should do and not obeying rules. And
she has a real sense of right and wrong.
She has a very strong sense of right and wrong. And the book is about right and wrong, really. I think that's at the heart of it. And therefore, she is at the emotional center of it because she is the person who really understands right and wrong. And although it seems in many ways to be petty, she also understands it, I think, on a much larger scale. But I mean, I absolutely am the person like Gloria who goes around going, oh my God, that person just dropped something. They should pick it up. But I don't quite run after people and tap them on the shoulder and say, excuse me, I think you dropped something. But I feel that day is coming. I just remember my daughter and I were driving along the street where I live, which is terribly middle class, and an incredibly middle class woman was walking past on the pavement, you know, in her lovely overcoat and everything, and she dropped a piece of litter. And my daughter actually did an emergency stop, and we both went, oh my God, did you see that? And I think it was because she was middle class that we felt this outrage. But my daughter was going, oh, I should have hooted the horn, I should have remembered it. And I was thinking, this woman is walking innocently along, not thinking anything, but she's a little out, she should be punished.
So she should know better.
She should know better. That really could be a strap line for this book, you know, they should know better.
Well, it's funny because here we are, we're at this Fringe Festival, and you live in Edinburgh, and it's definitely a character in the book. We'll have to talk about that. It's the characters are all a little bit off kilter, as is the town, because it's just inundated with artists.
Edinburgh has a population of just under 500,000, but during the festival it's 1,000,000. So, you know, that's a lot of people to suddenly be on the streets.
Well, and you know, with Julia and her cast of Motley Crue, and with Richard Mott, who is a comedian who is Martin's housemate, who frankly, evil befalls him in this book. He's a very good conduit for the actions and crimes that unfold. But these are people who you write about a lot, but they seem to lead these sort of small, unimaginative lives, though they are quote-unquote creative people. Meanwhile, you have Gloria Hatter, this housewife of 39 years, married to a business tycoon who's very shady in his dealings, and yet her imaginary life and the things she believes are much more vivid and understandable and translatable than anything Richard or Julia create in this.
Yes, that's true. I'd never thought of it like that, but it's true. I mean, she has an incredibly rich inner life, but she probably has my rich inner life. That's why. I think you always imbue a certain character with yourself, and then it's always difficult to answer that question when people say, is it autobiographical? Because obviously I'm not Gloria. I don't have Gloria's life. Nothing that's happened to Gloria has actually happened to me at all. And yet there's part of me is absolutely in her sensibilities. So it's a curious thing, I think.
Did you, you know, here we are again, just like in Case Histories, where we follow many different stories and storylines, and at first they seem totally separate, and as you say, though they were in the same place in the beginning, we have to read through the book to find how they intersect. Is it difficult for you when you start out to make all of those connections happen, or do they sort of evolve, as you were saying, you didn't know in the beginning just how much you dislike Graham?
They just evolve. I mean, I never plan anything or have notes, or because I have learned from past experience that, you know, if I make notes and think I'm going to do this and that, the minute I start writing, everything goes out the window. So there's no point in going through all of that, you know. So I just start. I had, because it happens in a very tight time frame for me anyway,
it's a week.
It's three days. Maybe just into four, that I had to keep track of them because, you know, there's the four main characters, and I just wrote a bit at a time, so I always knew where everybody was. I was, you know, it would be morning, so I knew what Gloria was doing in the morning, and then I would know what Martin would be doing. So it was really just to keeping track of the day and knowing where everyone was more than anything else. That was the structure, essentially, you know, just remembering where everyone was.
The structure also seems sort of to parallel a collection that our writer has in his house. One of his many fine things, he has a bunch of those Russian dolls that go into one another, and you take one out and another mystery unturned.
It's a really good motif for the book, but I hadn't actually thought of it, because I didn't really know what the structure of the book was until I was writing it, and the Russian dolls were there from the beginning. And then at the end I thought, oh, yes, that's really kind of what's happening is the Russian dolls. They became very important to me for some reason. I think because I've been to Russia. And when you, in St. Petersburg, it becomes a big thing for you, the buying of the Russian dolls, because you know you're going to do it at some point. And they are everywhere. And you become a connoisseur of Russian dolls. I went with a friend and we had it down. It was like, well, the ones over there are the good, and these are the ones, and those are the ones. And so we did this huge long recce before we bought our dolls. So I still regard myself as a kind of an expert on Russian dolls. And I felt that you couldn't have Russian characters in the book as you do in this book, or someone who has been to Russia without having the Russian dolls, because they were such an important part of it.
Well, it's interesting, too, because here in this town, you do have a lot of Russians, you have a lot of immigrants, and you seem to be uncovering in the novel, not to give anything away, but a sense that there is a migratory pattern and a way in which women especially are brought to town and brought into a different
world.
Well,
it's very interesting in the moment in Edinburgh, because Edinburgh is quite a rich town, and there are a lot of rich Russians now, and you know, there is questions over where that money came from. So we're now seeing a lot of Russian tourists as well, rich Russian tourists, people buying very expensive houses, I think, as investments for Russian, and a huge influx of East Europeans in Edinburgh. I mean, you know, I think 4 Polish delis have opened up in the last 6 months because, you know, since the EU opened the doors to Poland, they're everywhere. And I mean, you know, I'm talking about them as if they're some, you know, they're great. I mean, everyone likes the Poles because, you know, they're so well integrated, they're so hardworking. But to suddenly have a really significant new community of East Europeans is noticeable. I think that's what it is. And I felt that in the book, that it was something that somehow belonged in a contemporary Edinburgh. But also, I mean, you know, the Poles are not so much being exploited, but of course, East European girls are being exploited just phenomenally.
You know, they appear, and as we see them through Jackson Brody's eyes, they look alike. They come and they go. They die and they're alive. Yeah. There's this way of real transience
then
that
they're
I think
not people. They don't have characters. You know, they're not, which makes them less than real, I think. You know,
and they're
disposable.
The only people in your book who are disposable. In fact, every other character, no matter how minor, let's say there's 5 or 6 major characters in the work. You know, you really flesh them out. You give us their backstory. You tell us about their lives up till this point where we meet them. But every character who is Russian or is this just face of a crime is really all we know is the name
and even
the hair
Russian
color.
The Russian girl that we do get to know, we know she'll never tell us the truth. So it's
sort of lovely. You need this in a crime story. You need these people who you don't know and you wonder about. This is something that we talked about a year ago or so, too, with Case Histories, this idea that, you know, you were a novelist, capital, and now there's a question about you, Kate Atkinson.
Yes.
There's a sense that when you did Case Histories, everyone was sort of, one, totally enamored of the work, but also very confused by the nature of the work, because it was a mystery, though of course it was a mystery that you wrote, Kate Atkinson, so it flushed out your characters, it spent a lot of time with them, it showed their sort of interesting idiosyncrasies. Here again, we have this book it's not crime fiction, it's not a novel. How do you define it, or does it even matter?
I don't like, you know, the whole necessity to put things into a genre, into a book. So, and I've kind of avoided it because I don't feel I'm doing anything in particular. I just feel like I'm writing a novel, which is how I always feel what I'm doing. But I mean, I was aware with Case Histories, if you put a detective into a novel, it's going to become a crime novel. There's no kind of way around it. And then I don't feel I write traditional, crime novels. And I do have all these kind of questions, but then I think, well, You must be able to write novels that have crime in them and still, you know, not be put into a genre, surely. I mean, you know, Dostoevsky is writing about crime. People aren't going around saying, you know, oh, that's a crime novel. Dickens is writing about crime. So we just nowadays need to say that someone is doing something so that we feel safe, I think, you know. But I think I'm going to kind of push on through, because it's been a big question mark hanging over me. And I just think, well, you can write literary crime. Other people write literary crime. And, you know, there's no reason why I shouldn't. But also there's no reason why. I mean, in Britain, I don't know about here, I've been kind of born again as a crime writer. But in Britain, I haven't lost any readers from the literary novels. None of them are kind of saying, oh, we're not going to read that because it's a crime novel. They accept it as simply, you know, being a novel that's slightly more gory than my previous novels, I think.
And only slightly, in fact.
And
there's
only slightly, because
there's
always a lot of death in my books. And, you know, there's no real difference. And there's always a mystery at the heart of everything I write, because that's what I like. I like solving the mystery when I'm writing. So in that sense, there's no real difference. It is just having a policeman figure. You know, it's having the clear good guy. Yeah, having the clear good guy makes the difference, I think. And, you know, I just think if he wasn't in that, would it be a crime novel? Not really, I don't think.
Well, and the mysteries you seem to solve.
He's not really solving anything. I mean, he's pretty inept. In fact, somebody said to me the other day, he never wins a fight. And I thought, oh, I'm going to build him up a bit if I do another one. You know, he's going to... He's going to win a fight in the next book.
Well, as he says, you know, a coincidence is just an explanation waiting to happen. And you as a writer give us that explanation. And it seems like in your other books, the mysteries themselves are just about the human condition, like how this book to you seems to be about right and wrong, and what does it mean to be a person in the world and to interact with others, and to travel to other countries and to do right by people, your family and your friends.
Yeah.
It's interesting. So I wonder, though, with this kind of anger about classification, if it wasn't just extremely titillating to write about this writer, Martin Channing, and also his character, Nina Reilly, who, you know, he says that these books are, you know, soft-boiled crime. They're sort of the Miss Marple meets Dr. Finlay. And, you know, the BBC, when pitching to make them into a TV series, said they'll be perfect Sunday night viewing. And, of course, we all know that isn't really a compliment.
No, but it does fit into the kind of the BBC Sunday schedules, which are just awash with, and ITV too, are awash. There's a whole kind of crime on TV, which comes from novels, which my theory is, because they're quite long, they're almost 2-hour dramas in, you know, series. My theory is they're for old people, so they can fall asleep and wake up and nothing's happened because they're really slow paced. So, you know,
Was it your sweet revenge to write him, or was it just you sort of?
Not really, no. I quite like the idea of the Nina Reilly mystery. And I share with what Martin has, which is an interest in that post-war period in Britain and in Europe, because it's you know, it is the Vienna of the Third Man. There's something extraordinarily romantic in about the darkness and the kind of the gloominess of those years in the late 40s and the just the kind of the wretchedness. Why do I find all that attractive? I don't know. I know why I find it attractive. It's because I was born in 51. So they're the years that just precede my birth. So the years I've just missed. And I do feel that. I feel I would love, if I could choose a period to go back, I really think I would go back to something like 46, 47, just because I missed it, I think. But Nina Reilly, I would really like to write a small Nina Reilly book and just put it in as an appendage at some previous, because I really enjoyed writing Nina. I really, you know, there's not enough of her for my liking at all. Oh, she's so gung-ho. I mean, she's just...
Well, what does she do? She, like, retrieves a stolen racehorse and she helps infant Prince Charles, saves him. I mean, she does these large, bold actions that we know from...
Which Martin could never do.
Martin could never do. And frankly, Jackson Brody really doesn't do. No, real people don't do these things. Yeah. But these... You know.
In fact, if anyone was going to do those things, it would be Gloria. Yeah.
So tell us more about Gloria Hatter. It's interesting that you identify most with her. And I think you're talking about the sort of a moral constancy that she has. But how does she fit into all of this in terms of the emotional world that she inhabits and the way that the case moves along? We get to learn more and more as the novel unfolds, One Good Turn unfolds, about her husband and the sort of shady real estate dealings he does. You know, his Hatter homes is real homes for real people. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're shoddily made and falling about and crumbling. It seems to be this exercise in understanding class as much as anything else, writing about the Hatters.
But they're, well, I was going to say Graham is a self-made man, but actually he starts off from quite a good basis. He actually comes from an affluent sort of, not wealthy, but, you know, reasonably well-off middle-class family, whereas Gloria doesn't. So Gloria has started with different values to her husband. And I mean, I did try to, because the marriage is very far on in its disintegration.
39
and yet
years.
Still there. Yeah. And I did try to think what it would have been like in the early days. And I think... He is just very forceful, and I think she's not a forceful person, but she has become a forceful person, except that it's completely kept hidden. So a lot of people kind of have said, oh, desperate housewife, because it's such an easy adjective for us these days, isn't it? But she's not at all desperate. I found her to be an incredibly strong character, except that it's completely masked, which was quite interesting, because I never ever look at her and think that there's a weakness there. But she's utterly self-contained, because she's actually very isolated. I mean, she doesn't get on with her children, her grown-up children. And I was very dismissive about her children, I have to say. But I did feel that she had no real relationship with them. She has no relationship with her husband. She doesn't really have any friends. And I thought a woman that isolated could be incredibly depressed or neurotic, but she's not at all. She's just someone who's been biding her time, except she's been biding it for an awfully long time, I think.
Well, it's funny because she does. There, we have these passages in the book that imagine what it would be like without her husband, and she creates these scenarios and lives them out so vividly that you believe that they are happening. Mm. And it seems that most of our characters in One Good Turn live that way as well. Martin imagines his life to be very different from what it is in his his in his daily deeds, as does Jackson, I think. And
I think because Jackson's so uncomfortable in the life he's leading, I think he doesn't, I don't think he can even imagine beyond that. I think he starts imagining what it would be like if he hadn't, you know, if he'd followed the path of his father or his brother, if he hadn't, you know, joined the army. So it would be the life that he, you know, the path not taken, really, I suppose.
How we always compare ourselves. I mean, family plays a big role in this too. Yeah. Most of the major characters seem to have difficult relationships with their fathers-in-law or their fathers and mothers. Yeah. And that forms sort of how they react to the world and how they then react to their children.
Although the only person who I don't think leads an alternative life in their head is Louise, the policewoman. I think she's absolutely in her own life. It doesn't make her particularly happy, but it makes her very much her. I felt in a way she was, I mean, Gloria for me is the strongest person, but I felt Louise was the most comfortable within her skin. I think
she seems very rock solid throughout the book. Even when she's a single mom, she's a detective. She is, of course, instantly attractive to Jackson Brody.
Mm. Oh, what woman isn't? I mean, let's face it. He's just
We also talked about this last time. You know, Jackson Brody is the first time where you've really put yourself in a man's voice and taken him as a major character. And it seems to continually prove fun and entertaining for you because he is completely himself at all times, whether it's the fast cars, the sad tunes of Emmylou and Lucinda, or sort of wondering what his place is in the world and not being able to really figure it out.
No, he interiorizes a lot of stuff. I think in a way it's time for him to move on and stop. I think he's begun to mope, rather. I think he's begun to kind of, you know, just be a little too depressive for my liking.
Well, I thought it was a good sign. At the end of the book, he actually buys some Motown music.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, there might be hope for him.
No, I think it's the time for change.
So what made you come back to Jackson Brody and to Julia, who, of course, was so dramatic in the first book and so much about artifice in some ways. But here they are again. And of course, she especially just serves the role of moving forward with the story. But it seems like you're compelled by Jackson Brody, or at least we're at the close of Case Histories.
Well, I knew I was going to revisit him for sure, but I didn't expect it to be so soon. I mean, I came off Case Histories because I wrote it so quickly and I thought I could just keep on because I've got this voice, I've got this style. And then I thought, no, you're not going to do that. And it took me a year to come back, which was good because it meant I could come at it afresh. So now he's only one of several characters and the structure and the timing and the feel are different because Case Histories is a very sad book and it has a real melancholic emotional heart, whereas this isn't a sad book. I think it's quite, well, its original title is Jolly Murder Mystery. It's not exactly jolly, but it's more upbeat because it's faster as well, I think, and people aren't dwelling on the past, which is what they were doing in Case Histories. Everything's about forward movement, so it felt completely different, so I felt that I could revisit it. And just recently I've begun to realize that, you know, the rule of three is quite powerful, and I think I might do a third so that I can then move on and say, well, that's a trilogy. I'm leaving that behind. And revisit it, you know, if I live, revisit it at a later date. But just kind of, I often feel, you know, that when you've written two books, there's something missing. And so I kind of think, well, maybe I will do the third and then, you know, put the cap on it. So that would give me the opportunity to, you know, to write certain things so I can make him win a fight and be more cheerful generally.
And make him happy with the woman that he sees and loves.
Make him happy with the woman, yes. Well.
For a time.
Yeah.
It's interesting because you do get the sense of Jackson Brody where in the first book he was really this person who enabled all of these female characters to, including his own sister, you know, who died, sort of make a wrong a right again and keep the hurt and the abuse and the pain from these women and help them to heal, even if only by paying witness and homage to their lives. And in this book, he's a very different man in some ways. Mm. He really is just reacting to things and trying to avoid them and really at a loss. So I can see why we would want, as people who adore Jackson Brody, to see what happens, you know. Does he, you know, move on and move forward from what he's learned and the people and the strong women he's seen in this book and grow and learn from that.
Yes, because it's not that he's passive in this book, but the you know, circumstances happen to him rather than him controlling circumstances, which is, you know, what I wanted to happen to him. I didn't want him to be the proactive one. I wanted him to feel what it was like to be, you know, on the other end, as it were.
So he spends the night in jail. He's accused of assault and convicted.
Yeah, he's convicted. So, you know, he goes to the dark side. And I think he's learned things that he now needs to put into practice, perhaps.
It's always a good sign when you listen to some Motown, I think. So, I mean, we were talking too, you were just saying about One Good Turn being so, you know, forward-looking and also very funny, and that the pain and the hurt doesn't stay with you, that we're always sort of getting more. And I think In some ways, you know, Martin best exemplifies that. You know, he is a sad character in some ways. He only lives part of a life, and yet we laugh at him and with him so often in the book. You use humor to really show tragedy. We talked a little bit about this in Case Histories. How do you see humor as a result of the human condition, as a way of going through tragedy? It isn't used much in novels these days, I think.
No, that's true. It's not. And maybe if it is, it's used more subtly. I mean, I think in real life, I mean, because novels are just a kind of a playground, aren't they? I mean, you know, in real life, if a terrible tragedy happened, we probably wouldn't be laughing about it. Right? But because, you know, novels are a bit like horror films, they're a way of exploring the dark side, and, you know, like fairy tales. And so you can treat it differently, and you can say, well, actually, if that, I mean, we do have a terrible degree of schadenfreude in our lives, and we do laugh at tragedies if they're sort of removed from us. We wouldn't laugh at our own tragedies. But I mean, I don't set about to put humor in, or I don't set about to be funny. I mean, I don't know how you do that. I'd earn a lot of money if I knew how to do that. But it's just, it's what comes out in the writing, absolutely. You know, I was going to say I have no control over it. That's absolutely ridiculous, because obviously I construct the novel entirely myself. But it's just part of the flow of the writing. It's there, really.
And you make the characters so genuine and real people. You just sort of follow them along. As you said earlier, you don't map out what's going to happen. So then you just have to trust where they're leading you, I guess.
Yeah, which is scary.
It is scary.
In a way, but then...
Why know. Scary?
Well, because they might not lead you anywhere.
Right. mean, a year of your wasted life.
Yeah, they might just lead you to a blank page. I think, you know, always to be on that, you know, leading edge of the sentence is it's because you don't know if it's going to work. Because my main thing with the book is always thinking, is this going to work? Does it work? Will it work? You know, and it's because you're putting something together and you don't know if it's going to work until you've finished. And even then, you're hoping it has worked. So that there's always that element of not really knowing, I think, which is, I don't know, it's strange. I suppose you do just trust to it. But while you're writing it, it's not that you're not thinking, I mean, I'm not sitting there thinking, oh, this isn't a very good sentence, or this isn't funny, or this isn't that. It's just like, will the whole thing come together? And that's probably because it's not plotted out, you know. So it is like a puzzle more than anything. It's like, can I get all those pieces to fit together, and where will they go? And
will those Russian dolls all come completed?
Will they all fit together? And that's worrying, I suppose, is the word. Just you worry away like a dog would, really, more than anything. There's just a kind of, you have to be very tenacious when you write like that, to just keep on going, because, you know, there can be days when you're just thinking, this is rubbish, this doesn't work. And to be able to see a slightly bigger picture where you think, well, it will work.
Well, it sounds like a writer in some ways is like solving a great mystery. When you put it all together and you finish a book and everything comes and all the characters have solved what was their most pressing issue and we've seen how they all connect, you can feel pretty satisfied about it.
Mm. Well, it's nice to see them kind of do it, because I like endings, so it's nice to see everyone getting an ending.
Do you feel proud of them at the end?
I feel very proud of Gloria, yes.
She does have the last laugh, though we can't say
she
what
does.
It is.
Yes, she does have the best ending.
Well, Kate Atkinson, author of One Good Turn and Case Histories and many more, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Rick Kleffel, the Agony Column podcast. You can find additional reviews, interviews, print interviews, and book commentary 5 days a week at trashotron.com/agony.